If you're in a retirement plan, chances are good that some of your assets are in what is called a target date fund. 2 in every 5 401k participants held target date funds in 2012, which is twice the amount they were holding in 2006. Yet chances are that if you're using these funds the wrong way, you actually may be hurting your returns. That's the opinion of my guest, Ben Steverman, who is the deputy editor for Bloomberg News, and he's with me on the line right now. Hi, Ben. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So first of all, what are target date funds and why are they gaining in popularity?
Target date funds are supposed to be a very simple vehicle for saving for retirement. And the way they work is you pick a fund that corresponds to the year that you expect to retire. And as you get closer to retirement, the holdings in the fund are automatically adjusted. So the conventional advice is when you're younger, you should have more stocks. When you're older, you should have more bonds. And these funds automatically make those changes for you. You don't have to think about it. You don't have to rebalance your portfolio. Everything's handled for you.
So it's an all-in-one solution, basically, to a complex problem of people without kind of education in financial matters are not equipped to deal with how they should allocate their assets. This does it for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly.
And, you know, I mean, there are problems with this because, you know, I think there arguably people could say, you know, as I get older, I should still have a lot of stocks in the portfolio because, you know, people are living longer and longer and I still need those excess returns. But that's not really the point of the discussion here today. What you wrote in your article was while they have these benefits, they're not really being used correctly. You want to tell us about that?
Yeah. So one of the first lessons that most people learn about investing is that you should diversify. You should spread your investments around. Don't put all your eggs in one basket.
Mm-hmm.
What people are doing is instead of just using the target date fund as their entire retirement plan portfolio, they're using it for just a portion of their portfolio. So they're almost going down the menu in their 401k and they're choosing maybe 3 or 4 different funds and they're putting a little bit in this and put a little bit in that. And that's not how target date funds are meant to be used. You're supposed to really be putting your entire portfolio in them. And if you're not, then you're messing up the risk exposure. So you might have too many stocks or too many bonds or too much cash in your portfolio.
What a great point. Because if you're looking at a list of things and it's one of the lists, you're going to go, well, I'll add that to the list and choose some other items. But what you're basically saying is if you look under the hood and see what are in those target date funds, you would realize you don't need those other funds because for the most part, they're already in this one size fits all fund.
Yeah, and they're very diversified. You're owning lots of different bonds, lots of different stocks. You don't need to worry about that you're overly concentrated if you're in a target date fund.
Yeah, so that's a very good lesson. So if you're listening to this show and you're wondering, and you've got a 401k and you've got a target date fund, there is a cost or a downside to this diversifying between the target date funds and the rest of the options that are given to you. And Ben, what is that cost?
Well, the analysis that I'm relying on, some folks at Financial Engines and Aon Hewitt did an analysis, and they found that just partial exposure to target date funds hurt investment performance by about 2 percentage points a year,
mm-hmm.
which might not sound like a lot, but it is.
That
really compounds over time, and it could take a big bite out of your retirement nest egg.
Yeah, think about it this way. If inflation is running at 2 to 3% and you got that extra 2%, that would cover inflation right there. So now, if you're missing out on that 2%, you're asking the rest of the portfolio to cover inflation, and then what's left over is going to be a lot less. So 2% is an awful lot. What about portfolio risk? What does the allocation look like if you're mixing and matching these funds?
Well, you can either end up with too much risk or too little risk. Now, too much risk would be a problem if you're closer to retirement. So, and that's what they found. They found that people who are closer to retirement tend to be using the target date fund, but they're using it alongside riskier options like stock in the company that they work for, which is just a bad idea overall, or they're loading up in a bunch of other stock funds that are riskier than a target date fund. And then for younger workers, often what they're doing is taking a target date fund and then they're buying some bond funds or a cash fund, and they really don't need to be in bonds or cash at all in their retirement plans if they're in their 20s or 30s.
The risk we're talking about, too, is volatility risk. It's not risk of anything going out of business or permanent loss of your money. It's just the risk that things are going to be going up and going down. And when you're getting ready or you're approaching retirement, you really want to try to limit the amount of downside volatility because if you're going to start taking income from this thing, you really don't want to take it out at a period of time when things are low. So you want to have some more stable kind of investments in your portfolio and in your investing in order to draw from to get through the hard times. So when you come out at the end. So we always recommend as advisors that as you approach retirement, you reduce the amount of equities, but then 2 to 3 years after retirement, once you're in the groove and you know where you are in the cycle, you can start to increase once again. My guest is Ben Steverman. He's a deputy editor and writer for Bloomberg News, and we're talking about retirement funds too. But you know what, Ben? I read another article you wrote, and it's completely different. And I like the title and want to explore it. The title is Why Rich People Feel Poor. And I'm going to ask my listeners to put aside the caricatures of the rich that we see in pop culture, and just for a moment, hold the class warfare down, just for a moment. And let's first of all define by these statistics and these surveys that you rely on, what constitutes a 1%er or a rich person? What is the minimum amount of income?
In 2011, which is the last IRS data that I could get, the top 1% adjusted gross income is $389,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a lot of money, but there are actually a lot of people. You know, when we're talking about the top 1%, we're talking about billionaires and multimillionaires. We're often talking about people who are the top 0.1%.
Yeah.
And the top 1% could be a doctor, a really well-paid lawyer. It's not that hard to get up in that 1% if you have a well-paid professional job or if you run a really profitable small business.
I think you're exactly right, too. And also, in certain states or certain cities, it's easier to get this $389,000 than it is in other places. For New York City, you're going to be generally earning a lot more. Of course, you know, it's going to match more of the cost of living, but it's for just concentrating on earnings, $389,000. So we're not talking about the top 0.1%. You know, the reason that this number, I don't think this number sounds that high, but the median income of a person in the United States is $50,000 a year. So relative to that, it actually is pretty high. So Ben, why do rich people feel poor? What was the kind of the statement you were making in this article?
Well, when I talk about rich people feeling poor, I'm really talking about rich Americans feeling poor. And the problem that they face is that they're paying relatively high taxes. Actually, you know, they're paying about the same level of taxes as people in other developed countries. If you look at Europe, Sweden has much higher taxes, Japan has higher taxes, but most of Europe has about the same tax rate for wealthy people. By the way, that tax rate just recently went up a couple of years ago when President Obama raised taxes on the top, I think it was incomes over $450,000 a year for a couple. So they're paying about the same taxes as folks in other countries, but they're really not getting much bang for that buck. And we can go through that analysis that I did. Basically, college in the United States is incredibly expensive, and it's getting more expensive. So if you think about a couple that just had twins, in about 18 years, they're going to be shipping them off to college. If they don't get any financial aid, you're talking about a potential cost of $500,000 each, so $1 million total. So that's $1 million for college. You have to think about if you're making good money and you have high expenses, you need a substantial emergency fund. If you are planning for retirement, you have to think about health care costs in retirement. Medicare doesn't cover everything. You have to think about long-term care costs because long-term care is covered by Medicaid for very low-income seniors, but it's not going to be covering your health, long-term care expenses if you're wealthy. And if you add all that up, you're talking about maybe about $2 million that a upper-income couple has to save. Not all at once. They have plenty of time, and they have potentially have good income as long as they can keep that income coming in to do those things. But my point is that that's why an American couple making good money often feels insecure because they don't have the safety net that folks in other countries have where healthcare is paid for and where college is paid for.
Yeah, so I think the idea you're putting forth here is that using your example of a couple having to have $2 million saved, the idea here is that this $2 million is to meet these basic future needs, whereas in other countries, while you know they may be taxed the same, a lot of those future needs are taken care of by the government or something like that.
Yeah, and if you don't have to worry about healthcare, you don't have to worry about education costs, you can kind of enjoy your wealth a little bit more. You don't have to worry about squirreling it away somewhere just in case something comes along.
Right.
You know, these wealthy families, you know, if somebody has a disabled child, even a disabled grandchild, that can potentially be a large expense that really isn't going to be covered for you. So you really actually do need to be thinking about saving a lot of what you earn. As I said, rather than going on lots of vacations or buying fur coats or whatever the caricature is, and there's still plenty of people who go off and do those things, but it's smart for wealthy people to be saving just along with everybody else.
Yeah, so the key here is, the key premise of this idea is that while all these things have to be saved for, this is now done in the face of higher tax rates, which can approach, if you live in a state that has a state income tax and a city within that state that has a city income tax, and then you add on the federal income tax and then the deduction for Social Security, you know, you're talking, you know, something like 55% of your income or so is going out the door. So it's, you're using what's left to fund these future needs. And then what's left after that is what you're actually living on. So it explains this feeling of why rich people feel poor. And just to wrap this up, I mean, you know, people who are not making this kind of money have a lot of these same struggles too. So it's not just the rich people who, you know, require the violins here. I think it's just tough all around.
It is. It is. The rest of us have to cover a lot of these same, very same expenses. Of course, we don't have, you know, $400,000 coming in the door to do so. Mm-hmm. And it just points out the fact that we're not really getting the financial safety net that other countries get for their dollar. And it's not just the wealthy people that don't get that. It's everybody else, too.
Interesting. My guest, Ben Steverman, deputy editor for Bloomberg News. Thank you so much for joining us, Ben.
Thank you.